to GalacticConnection.com, one of the most popular blogs on the World Wide Web today for alternative news. Stay tuned for the latest information on our world shift from enslavement to galactic involvement, as well as current intel on any blockages impeding us from our sovereign birthright. Knowledge and self-mastery are key at this time. Our commitment is to present you with the latest breaking conspiratorial articles, off-world messages, exopolitics, cutting-edge technologies and sciences, and also an ever-significant intertwining of spiritual support and metaphysical scope that one needs to dive down the rabbit hole and search for truth with balance. We are truly on the horizon of a new golden age filled with the promise for more love, worldwide peace, and accelerated intuitive skills, where every living being can exist in cohesion and abundance. It is whatever we envision and dream this new world to be. I say to you now, let's redefine the new world to the beginnings of our own precious heaven on Earth. Galactic Connection is here to provide the pulse of Mother Earth through an eclectic range of interviews each Tuesday afternoon from 3 to 4:55 p.m., Pacific Standard Time, Station 2 on BBS Radio, expanding your perspectives on how we can once and for all take back our freedoms, our joy, and our connection with our mighty I Am presence. Our intention remains true to connect hearts and minds everywhere in order to obtain global unity and galactic and universal acceptance. Our discussions will continue to cover anything to do with galactic society and our involvement with our galactic brothers and sisters. Our guests are experts in their fields, and our radio shows have been coined as some of the most thought-provoking out there. In addition to our daily blog, which runs 365 days a year, we also offer a realm of healing services such as our world-renowned implant removal processes, our spiritual past life clearings, our galactic violet ray alchemy from Alexandra, who shares in the lineage of Merlin, and other cutting-edge healing technologies. Check our site out at galacticconnection.com now. Sending you a wave of light, love, and inspiration, and a personal hug and thank you for listening to our Galactic Connection radio show and visiting our blog today. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Alexandra Benners of GalacticConnection.com, and this is a pre-recorded interview, and I don't know about the date. So, but it's in the month of August 2016, and I have a special guest today. I am personally visiting Michael Alesian and his girlfriend, Laura Legere, and in so doing, we got to talking about some really cool subjects that we could discuss. I think many of you are aware of Michael. He has quite the reputation for being one of the channelers for Ashtar. And he basically entered this world without the what he refers to as the cosmic amnesia veil. He's been involved in all of the Edgar Cayce trainings for channeling at a very, very early age. He's actually had two physical contacts himself aboard ships, which is really cool. He typically channels many of the masters, and in particular Ashtar, and he offers a really dynamite 90-minute personal transformational channeled reading, which is just phenomenal. I've experienced myself. It has just oodles of information, and it really helps you connect the dots on your galactic journey throughout life. So we thought today we would do this together, since we're actually in underneath the same ceiling here. And today he really wants to share his knowledge and background and just some of the experiences he's had with some of the real major players that brought ufology out to the world, you know, really created the awareness of the ufology field, and, you know, prominent names such as George Adamski and George Van Tassel and Howard Menger and Dr. Daniel Fry and Orfeo Angelucci, just to name a few. So let's go ahead and just start with that. First, I just want to thank you, Michael. It's been a really fun experience so far.
Yes, it has.
And we've learned a lot just hanging out together. Mm-hmm. And I think
one of the things I was not aware of is how much knowledge he has in the ufology field. I mean, I was just like blown away to the point where I said, oh my God, I gotta share this with the world. So do us a favor. I mean, kind of first start out with just a brief intro, because a lot of people can find that in my other interview with you and other interviews you've done. Maybe just give them a brief introduction of your knowledge and your interest in this, you know, like what got you really fired up in this field.
Well, also I would say too, because one of the things that you want to do with the Galactic Connection is connect ufology with the spirituality and the conspiracy area. And that was something that I was doing, and because two of my missions, basically, because I came into this life, as you say, without the cosmic amnesia veils. So I have all this memory, and I've actually struggled with this life, trying to ground myself. I joke about wearing gravity boots to try to hold myself down. And it's coming in with this higher perspective, and then having two physical contacts that have verified the memories I carried with me. Now, in regard to some of the names you mentioned, that like George Van Tassel, who I got to know a little bit before he was actually physically taken off the planet, there has been this really massive hidden agenda conspiracy, I would call it, a conspiracy of silence within the modern-day UFO community, that they like to refer to these early pioneers like George Adamski, George Van Tassel, actually in a very disrespectful way, as the lunatic fringe. I mean, this is people who have, you know, claim to be professional UFO investigators, which is really meaning they're a spin doctor, they're an agent of disinformation, because they like to take the spirituality out of it and talk about all the mysterious lights in the sky, like they're investigating something mystery, or all the negative alien abductions. And I went to all the conferences in the 1980s and 90s. Now, I'm jumping forward a little bit more recently just to give a little perspective here, because a lot of people who are, and I'm going to be celebrating my 63rd time around the sun coming up this September. But I feel like in my 20s or 30s, I don't, what is age? As Astor says, it's not how many times you've been around the sun, it's your passion, it's your physiological age. Now, yes, when I was taken aboard the ship in 1979, I had my DNA RNA altered because of an experience of having literally being offed with the use of psychic deadly force. I was hit with a psychotronic beam of the cabal and ripped the life force out of my body, and next thing was waking up on the ship and with the four Elohim standing around me, well, they're putting the life force back into me. And
that's amazing.
And I went out of my body at one point and watched them while they were altering my DNA RNA, took the blood out of my body and put it through this kind of machine to kind of purify. It was like kind of like oil and water. It was kind of an effect sloshing around it. And see, part of that was also for activation for my transformational sessions. Sometimes, you know, sometimes we have a negative experience per se, and then after that we have a wonderful experience. And that's what happened, and because my mission wasn't over. Now, I am jumping ahead a little bit, but I'm just saying that one of the reasons I don't feel in the chronological sense of my 60s, because of what I've gone through and having spent my entire life and eating a very, you know, usually a very pure diet, and I've done a lot of meditation and do a lot of things that keep my body in a healthy state, because being a channel, I felt it was very important to be as clear as possible. Good. And I always tell people, as far as my friends off the planet Ashtar and all the friends we hung out with before we came to Earth and divine creation, I give them most of the credit, or I wouldn't be here today. They come all trying to off me so many times, I lost count. But the only credit I take is to keep myself as a guardian, keep myself as a clear channel for whatever they want to bring through. And of course, you have a huge amount of, through their consciousness, Elohim technology. One of the things about my transformational readings is that they download these higher light encodements that the conscious mind doesn't hear, but the subconscious does. So more than just when you experience being able to play it back, and that's when the transformational effect begins to happen. But I think I'll go back and kind of the, you know, as the old saying, which comes first, the chicken or the egg?
Well, wait, before you do that,
when you
actually got offed,
yes,
and you came to, and you had the four Elohim around you, what were they doing?
Well, first of all, they're Elohim. See, the word Elohim, there's different levels of Elohim beings. And these beings were dressed, and they looked totally human-appearing, humanoid, dressed in blue metallic suits, very shiny blue suits.
Wow.
And in fact, all the beings on the ship were in blue, silver, and white uniforms, except for one, and that was Corton. And now it's interesting when I realized later, he's dressed in red and gold. that's an honor guard type outfit that they're wearing. I didn't realize he was kind of playing honor to me, he tells me later, and I'm thinking, well, I'm just, I would thank God they took me aboard. I'm lucky to, you know, but it really wasn't luck. It was because, you know, my mission wasn't over, but when I connect with him, and again, I'm, it, you know, he has an old friend, I remember hanging up with him in the councils. But I just want to give a little perspective that leads up to this experience, you know, because going back to the beginning of this life and coming in without the cosmic energy veil, so, and remembering all these things and constantly comparing, you know, that's been my big thing, but comparing the mundane earth level around me with the higher paradise worlds and then the councils and the board, the Merkabah light ships. I mean, that's normal. That's the real reality that all of us, that Ashtar likes to call the ground crew, you know, volunteers in earth embodiment, the boots on the ground. We're the cleanup crew, basically. But it's good to have a good cosmic backup team off the planet watching your backside. It really is, with what the Cabal has been trying to do to silence and squelch the reality, and or to put a spin on it in regard to the UFO community. But when I came into this life, and remember very clearly choosing my earth parents, because of my earth biological parents, because of their metaphysical and holistic background. Huh. Now, the holistic was very important, and I emphasize that because, you know, a lot of people are brainwashed by the medical profession that there are certain things like vaccines and things that are actually good for us, but no, they're very destructive to our, not only our physical well-being, our immunity, but our consciousness. And so my parents, I chose, were very holistic, and so we were very aware, so I didn't have vaccines, I didn't have fluoride, I didn't drink coffee, and I was basically a vegetarian. Yeah, so that created in a condition in my physical body to be able to retain more of the higher energy that I brought into my physical body. My temple, really, and we either treat it as a temple or a cesspool. I always tell people, you either are a fast-moving, clean river, or you're a swampy bog by how you're eating and the environmental conditions. And people treat themselves, you know, kind of like a cesspool sometimes, and don't realize, hey, you know, your physical body has the potential to live a lot longer and be healthier and be happier and have a lot more fun if you're treating it with some respect. But anyway, so my parents were very hip to that, and that allowed me to retain more of the energy. Now, I invite the, you know, audience to check out my website, michaelelijan.com, and the NASA Star People Characteristic List that's there. See how many, ballpark figure, what percentage of those star, those characteristics or traits that you relate to. Because how much energy you've been able to retain is how many of those characteristics you have. So my parents being very much into the Edgar Cayce teachings, and my father was a professional stage hypnotist, and he was doing a lot of research about the life of Cayce, and came across the fact that Edgar Cayce was actually activated by, because he went to a psychiatrist, a hypnotist. He had a little personal problem. He went to the psychiatrist so he could be put under, and under hypnosis you can do a lot of wonderful things. Well, he learned to induce that state himself that the psychiatrist, the hypnotist, put him under, and that and the rest of his history became known as the famous sleeping prophet. Now, the ARA, the Associate Research and Enlightenment in Virginia Beach, doesn't really want to talk too much about that point because they want to make it sound a little more unique and unusual. But what I tuned into, if you go back to the oracle traditions, and this was long before Delphi, because by Delphi it had actually become somewhat corrupted, but prior to that, going way back, there was always somebody like a hypnotist hanging out with the perpetual channels, the oracles.
Right,
and
right.
There are actually millions of forms of oracle channeling, which of course I teach in my channeling classes, because even though my 90-minute transformational channel readings kind of have a residue effect that helps to open people up, the channeling workshop specifically teaches the techniques to help you fine-tune. Because as far as channeling is concerned, we're all channeling life force. How well are you able to interpret the signals while they're coming through you? And so it's a matter of learning how to fine-tune and tune into all those signals that are constantly. And Ashtar says all the time that they're broadcasting millions of transmissions constantly, and even the most attuned channels and contactees only pick up a few of them.
Talk about the whole, just, there's like a real black cloud over channeling, and the fact that everybody's pretty paranoid about, you know, trusting the information that comes through channelings.
Like, who's on the other end of the line?
Correct.
I understand that concern.
That.
Well, you must definitely be discerning. I have a little philosophy that I kind of say, it doesn't matter if it's human, galactic, or interdimensional. I'm not going to hang out with beings or people or who aren't, you know, aligned with the same sacred principles that I'm embracing. And that we as sovereign beings have a right to choose the environment and the conditions. And I know, of course, as a light guardian, I've been a light warrior. As a very early age, I don't talk too much about this, but I was attacked by the demonic forces quite severely because I came in with conscious memory. So it was like painting a target on my back. Like part of my mission was to expose the cabal, document it, get out in the open, and there was to be a cosmic telephone line. So helping the fellow volunteers, members of the ground crew, understand their mission, but also to expose the whole cover-up on our friends off the planet. And basically, as far as the UFO community, it's been mostly the cover-up on human-appearing ETs, higher-dimensional beings, Elohim beings, or the Astral Commander, the beings are the guardians to this planet. And those were the kind of beings in the 1950s and 60s that George Adamski and George Van Tassel had contact with, both channeling and physical contact with, and all of the contactees did. And, and they referred to them as the Space Brothers, the boys topside, the space people. And, of course, that was because that was a term of respect. Even David Wilcock, I really have to laugh that, he has some of his insiders, and I met a number of people in the Black Op agencies that show up at my events, but his insiders made the comment that the military got really freaked out. I mean, they were angry because the higher forces would cause the, select times when they wanted to launch a missile, they couldn't because all the bolts were laying around on the ground, and they would turn the bolts into flowers. So they referred to them as those damn hippies from outer space. And Astra says to me, I'm proud of that title, those damn hippies from outer space. So, they did these things that were very humorous sometimes, even though they were seriously intervening to stop the chaos and the misuse of power and things that have been going on this planet.
So question, why do you feel that there was such an uprise of flying saucer visitations and viewings in the early 1950s?
Well, it was definitely related to the dropping the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the misuse of development of nuclear power and weapons on this planet. And, of course, all the major, from the United States to in Nazi Germany, they had developed a nuclear program. As a matter of fact, there's evidence that the two bombs dropped in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were from Germany, actually, because they were further along than the United States was on the Manhattan Project, according to people I've talked to who have been in the military, people like Colonel Wendell Stevens, who I got to know quite well.
Well, everything gets back to the Nazis.
Right, and they actually developed anti-gravity. Joseph Farrow did a whole book on that right toward the end of the war. If the war had not ended when it did, 2 weeks later, that's to say the war would have ended entirely different. And there's evidence, if you look at the timeline changes, and this is a whole different topic, it's my perception that those of us who have actually come from the future, in a sense, that our hair stuff came back and changed the outcome of certain major events, such as the Civil War and World War II. In the original timeline, South won and the Axis won in the end of World War II. We came back and changed that, and so it's entirely different. Nevertheless, though, there was all this secret development of anti-gravity and development. Eventually, the Nazis, developed a whole fleet. And if you talk to some people like, Corey Goody and different people among the secret space program, they talk about one of the groups out there is the Nazis who developed their own fleet.
I think another reason that there was such proliferation of sightings in the early 50s, especially with some of these major names, is because we had finally accelerated our scientific exploration and our documentation and all of the things that we had discovered by that time, because they were really ramping it up, obviously, by 1945, 1946. And we obviously know that there's quite a few things that happened, but it seemed like right around the Korean War, it really started ramping up again.
Well, also, in the late 40s and early 50s, a huge group of volunteers took Earth embodiment, termed the Star People. They used to call us the Wanderers. That was a term in the 1950s among some of the contactees. And so it was like they were coming back to make their presence known, to kind of remind those that were in Earth embodiment and the contactees they began to have physical contact with that, hey, we're still here. We're watching over you on your missions. And if you study, though, the life of, you know, contactees that we've already referred to, actually, from my understanding, I've been told that there were actually thousands of people, contactees, that were contacted, volunteers of Earth embodiment. But because of once one takes Earth embodiment, they get involved in the mundane things and they're concerned about their birth biological families thing. People like George Van Tassel, George Adamski, and Aaron Minter, and some of those, they were actually a very few number who had the courage, who kind of had the thing of, I've got to do this. I don't care what anyone else thinks. I've got to get the truth out.
Yeah.
A lot of there was huge numbers of volunteers being down that were supposed to have become other contactees, and they didn't. They couldn't quite finish, you know, getting involved in it because of, again, family concerns and everything you can imagine distracted them. And then people, you know, not very open to any of this higher reality.
You know, from what I've read, it seems like there's a common theme in the visitations involved statements like, well, we are contacting all of you from far, far away. Mm-hmm. And it seemed to be Venusian.
Well, some of them were from Venus, Mars, Saturn. Howard Menger, when he brought a book From Outer Space to You, he set up actually homes and places that the human-appearing beings could come and live incognito. I met a few of them in years past, that have been here living, dressed in Earth clothes, having normal jobs, quote-unquote, and they did that for a while. More recently, there isn't that many doing it as there was because Earth got increasingly more polluted, from the EMF fields surrounding Earth to the negative psychotronics to mind control, everything you can imagine. So they felt a little vulnerable. But in the 50s and 60s, there was a whole program of having them come down and live incognito. What I think I'd like to do is just, again, kind of go back to my early experiences that kind of set the stage for not only bringing the information out in the open, but as a channel. And at a very early age, when Ashtar and Archangel Michael and Saint Germain and the whole team, who I related to more than all the mundane humans down here, what can I say? They understood me, I understood them. Because of that, I started going into altered states and talking in my sleep as one of the kind of side effects. And my father, who had studied Casey, thought, hey, I can train my son in the same way that Casey, through his own experience, was activated that way. So by 15, by word of mouth, up and down California, people would come to me for these what I call karmic sessions. Very much like Casey's, they were about past lives and dietary and emotional kinds of stuff. And these were people getting ready to get off the wheel of karma. Now, I was glad I could do this work. I didn't remember anything unless I listened to the tapes. But I didn't really relate that much to these people. I was glad I could do the work. And it was preparing me to be the cosmic telephone line that I was supposed to be. Well, of course, things shifted in 1979. But before I get to that, my first physical contact that happened around 6 years of age in the summer of 1959. And this was written into my life script. You know, I had to have it through close calls. I mean, if you look at it, if it was all dull and boring, it wouldn't be quite so hair-raising and exciting, I guess. You know, if we're on the edge of our seats, like, oh, and I'm alive. I'm not just mentally existing.
Well, I think falling 40-something feet off of the pier was pretty exciting, huh, Michael?
Well, that's one way to say it, I found out years later that the kids in that area would challenge himself to get up on the railing of the pier and do this little balancing act. I mean, that's totally dangerous, but kids will kind of see who can outdo one another. And I thought, okay, I'll do it too. And I always say, I guess I look kind of cute. And then my foot slipped off the side and there I went, you know, down in the ocean. One moment.
Did you have your gifts before that happened?
Well, with the conscious memory, in that sense, I was aware, but I could say that, you know, time went on and my father worked with me and then I started doing the channeling work specifically. In that sense, it was developed to do that kind of thing. But I came in with the veils off. So, you know, I mean, and for me, I have to say the first part of my life up until then, I have not much memory about being here. I was almost like I was struggling to ground myself and back off the planet and trying to keep my, that kind of thing. But yeah. When I fell off the pier, at one moment of terrifying fall, And next moment, they had physically beamed me back into what I call our home environment. For me, it was my home environment. Back, I'm suddenly back on the light ship, and as my understanding is, I was on this sixth-dimensional plane. And the beings standing around me in this chamber, this beautiful, all the walls were lit up and beautiful. Now, these beings were very human-appearing, and they were dressed in silver-blue metallic suits. But had they been dressed in Earth clothes, you would have thought they were the average good-looking person.
Right.
Now, to me, it was the love. It was the connection I had with them. And of course, people often ask me, well, how long were you on the ship? And, you know, there is no time on that level. Mm-hmm. And I always tell people, well, it wasn't as long as I was hoping it was going to be.
You know? And you had to come back.
Yeah, I had to come back. I mean, God, I was going to hang out there as long as possible.
Exactly.
Now, what's very interesting about that, there were three people I've linked with in the years since then, or more recent years, as I became public and started talking about things. These three people said that they were very aware, and they were children. At the time, I met a woman who was also 6 years of age on that date. Her father was in Canadian military intelligence, and he was down to go to Camp Pendleton, which is a military base right near the Oceanside area. And it was the only time he ever came to the United States, and she was there with him, and they're walking along the pier. She's 6 years of age, and she remembers this little six-year-old kid getting up on the rail and falling off the pier. It was very dramatic and
wow. Everything.
Yeah. And
what are the chances of meeting somebody?
I know.
And I
think I did a reading for her. And then two other people tell me, a man and a woman, that they were inside the ship. Now, I don't remember them because I wasn't looking in their direction, but
right. They
were behind me. They remember me over there, higher beings are around me, and they're looking at me from this kind of from the corridor. Okay. So those were kind of interesting confirmations of my experience. And the thing that, and of course I share this in my book, Prepare for the Landings, which you can get through Amazon, copies of the book, Prepare for the Landings, Are You Ready? But two of the things that I always share, because they stand out among all the things they were sharing with me. And one of the things was, it was like the holodeck on Star Trek on steroids, because I played back all around me, smell, sound, everything, holographically, verifying the memories that I carried with me, which was really awesome and wonderful. And then at a point, one of the beings I connected with, named Orion, who, interesting enough, Odeo Lanza Luce Orfeo Lanza Luce, I'm pronouncing it, he had all an experience in the 1950s where he was physically taken aboard, his soul actually left his physical body, he's taken aboard the ship, and he goes into his immortal light body that was in storage on the ship. And it was Orion who he connects with on board the ship. He was an Italian contactee living here in the U.S. But Orion was also the being that who's connected with the Orion Council of Light, and as part of a group called the Jerusalem Command that Dr. Hertek talks about in the book of Knowledge Keys of Enoch. And the Jerusalem Command works with the Ashtar Command. They're like two of the main guardian groups who have authority to activate mass planetary divine intervention.
They're like the military arm. Right?
Yeah, the military arm. The Ashtar Command is like the military arm of the Federation of Light. So the experience that one of the things that Orion specifically point he made to me telepathically, he said, your personal experience that you're having today is verification, confirmation for a time in the future when mass planetary divine intervention is going to take place. In other words, my personal experience of being lifted up and there was intervention was, in a sense, an analogy to a collective kind of thing. Excuse me. Now, that having been said, and I always like to really make this point when I mention it, we're in a new timeline. That up until slightly before 2012, according to my understanding of the old timeline, only a third of humanity was going to survive during this change, and it was going to be an emergency worldwide evacuation. Now, Tuella's book, Project World Evacuation with the Ashtar Command, was very accurate about what would have happened had that timeline played out. And it's my understanding that, a group of us, about 20 million years linear time in the future, chose to come back because when we looked around the galaxy, a third of the galaxy didn't exist and Earth didn't exist because of the wars with the dark side. So we came up with this harebrained, some many beings thought it was a suicide mission. And we're going to go back in time, linear sense of time, about 26.5 million years, and impact the timeline and change the outcome. And we had to change it a few times to get into the timeline we are now. So now, I know that you know, certain ones have different perceptions about how many are going to make it through. I keep being told 90 to, now this is astrocytes, it's not a rigid thing, it's an approximate energetic scan, a potential of that 90-95% of many has the potential through a series of what used to be evacuation waves will now be first contact waves. Mm-hmm. Some must be taken up first, a little R&R, you know, it's like a cosmic done deal, sacred promise. They promised us once we fulfilled a certain stage of our mission, we're going to have a little R&R.
Okay, hold on, stop for 1 second. Because if we're going to have first contact, define mm-hmm. that, because I think that's what causes a lot of misunderstandings. Mm-hmm. So are you talking first contact where that is considered they go up on the ship, but they still have their physical conscious body continuing to conduct their lives?
Well, first of all, we're going to be physically taken on
okay.
board.
So we're not going to show up at all first contact.
What do you mean?
Here, in this reality.
We're going to be gone physically all over the planet.
Because, you know, there's all these different theories.
Yes, I know.
Okay.
And I don't want to come off as, oh, you, this is the only way. I'm open, you know, because I feel there's some alterations. But it's my perception from the get-go, from the time I was young, and I remember sitting in the councils discussing yeah. this very thing, okay?
Big time.
And there is a lot of agree-to-disagree conversations up there. We just don't get our feathers ruffled and get into, oh, I'm right and you're wrong, and this
exactly.
ego kind of thing, as I've seen occur often in the UFO community kind of thing.
But in your opinion, you think, or you've been led to be told
they're going
to
appear all over the planet.
They're going to appear all over the planet. Okay, and a certain percentage of the population is going to disappear. They're going mm-hmm. to be beamed up to the ships.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to have some rest time. They're going to get rejuvenated, maybe go through healings, and then they're going to come back.
Well, actually, first contact is that the smaller scout ships literally land.
Okay,
a ramp comes down. They walk out down and say, you know, hello, whatever they're going to say. Well, you know, imagine what they're going to do. It's going to embrace us because they're our cosmic extended family, you know?
You know, they're going to say hello?
Yeah, well, hello, how you doing? No, you know. No, there's no, it's only one time to do this. There's no way of doing it over, so you want to make sure you're...
You don't screw it up.
No, but it's, I mean, we're just going to embrace. I mean, we're reconnecting with our brothers and sisters that we've been hanging, we used to hang out in the councils. That's one thing about my workshop, the Who's Who in the Cosmic Directory, which is the beautiful images by a clairvoyant artist known as Sleigh Winkler. She was another, let's say, pioneer in the 1950s and 60s who painted thousands of these images. And so in my Who's Who in the Cosmic Directory workshop, there's 30 beautiful images of these different beings, or just a few of the many beings we used to hang out with. So we're reconnecting with our friends, old friends, and from all over the universe. We've got quite a lot of like club parties being planned. Okay, now, so they're going to take us, the smaller ship will go into the mothership, into the hangar bay, and I always tell people the one scene that I always see, and it's kind of hilarious, but it's awesome, is everybody making a beeline to the rejuvenation chamber set up right there in the hangar bay, and people are going to be, I mean, you're running to that rejuvenation chamber. And it's cool because in some of the chambers, depending on, some of them are like 20 feet long because there's a mirror along the wall as you're walking. And it's almost like in slow motion because you're walking through this energetic field. And it's a decontamination chamber also to kind of, and you're watching yourself in the mirror for people who are older, changing, getting younger. You know, which is physiologically, what is that? How does that feel to go through something like that?
So are we going to come back younger?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we're coming back with our powers and abilities that we left behind before we came into earth embodiment. See, this is the whole thing, and Astra talks about all the time, about the human merging with the Elohim. What kind of interesting perspective and contrast when you have emergence. All of us who've been on the front lines taking a lot of flack down here, who've been dedicated, we made a vow millions of years ago that we keep coming back until the job is over, and now this life right now is the time. And we're coming up to the end of our tour. And we've had it seems like a few extensions of other tours. But anyway, but I just wanted to getting back to that first experience, as you know, as it came close to the finally the time that I know, God, I'm going to have to, you know, beam me back to Earth. God. And Orion turns to me telepathically and he said, oh, by the way, you're about to bump into an old friend of ours named Ashtar, which I remember hanging out in the councils, an old friend.
Sure.
And so 2 or 3 years later, as sitting in front of my little black and white TV there in Vista, California, near 7 miles from Oceanside, and I'm watching President Kennedy's news conference on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And, of course, for most Americans, this was a very, you know, a time of uncertainty where there were going to be a knowledge in a nuclear war. Now, for us contactees, we had a different perception. Because, anyway, I'm watching the newscast, and all of a sudden, Ashtar pops into the room. Now, he's standing there, and, of course, you know, he's standing there etheric. I saw him very clearly, but most of you have to be clairvoyant to see him. But I always tell people, he looked more real than most of the mundane humans I saw walking around Earth. And he says to me telepathically, his first words to me, he goes, we're not going to allow nuclear war. It's against Federation policy, which I knew, but it was great to have him reinstate that.
Sure.
Of course, you have to understand, when I got into public school, and a teacher tells me, tells us to get underneath our desk and put our arm over our head,
right,
and that's supposed to protect us. You know, and it's like, they're really crazy on this planet.
And I know, I still can't believe
it. It kind of reminds me years later, after the false flag of 9/11, of course, on the day 9/11 happened, Ashtar told me it was a false flag. It was a big put on to, you know, cause. And there were more than 3,000 people in that building. And I was told they were beamed up out of the building, most of them.
Absolutely.
The mothership. And anyway, but it kind of reminds me of, they told me to get anything to my desk, when the newscaster, the corporate newscast, tells everybody, get your duct tape and run. And that's going to protect you. It's kind of the same thing. But anyway, getting back to that experience and Ashtar popping in the room and announcing, declaring this. And he was also telling me how they were coming over down over a military basis and shutting down all the missiles. And of course, years later, I meet all these old guys, part of disclosure, and telling me how they were at various military bases watching the UFOs come down, shut all the missiles. So I get all these confirmations as the years go by. Anyway, so as time came about, coming up to the second experience, and that's when the cabal hit me with the psychotronic beam. I was up in Agora, which is north of San Diego, L.A., when this experience happened, and ripping the life force out of my body. And then next thing was waking up on the ship with them standing around me, the Elohim putting the life force back into me. Now, I have to say, and I have to say this, I have never lived my life out of fear. From the time I was born, I remember where I came from. I knew if anything happened to me, I knew where I was going to go back to. In fact, I tell people, you know, we're all missing out on these great light club parties up there. Really, I mean, we have, that makes the parties down here look like, man, really dull and boring. Up there, we have the banquet of the gods, we have the nectar of the gods, these light-infused drinks. And there are beings like Lord Rokan who loves to really put on some big parties and celebrations that make, you know, as I said, really things on this planet's extremely dull and boring. But for me, but I knew my mission wasn't over. So I'm waking up on the ship, they're bringing back to life, and they're putting the life force into me. And as the analogy I would say is, I felt so empowered. I felt like I could have jumped over a building and take on the entire Illuminati, the entire cabal, single-handed. That's how I felt. And I thought, well, you know, I thought, I'm going to have fun with their brain. I didn't hate these little black ops who sit around their posts muttering, but I thought, I'm going to have fun with their brain when I get back. So one of my missions was to be a thorn in the butt with the cabal and have, let them know I know they know that I know they know. You know, it's like, hey, guess what? I realized, I looked back on it years later, that I was kind of starting some of the early disclosure process, because I estimate during the 80s and 90s, when I would go to conferences or I would put on my own, I put on thousands of workshops myself, and I'm estimating 200 to 300 guys that were in the black op agencies or had retired, and they would show up. And the thing that was clear to me, the only people who were allowed to show up at my events, because I had a cosmic security frequency code around it, were fellow volunteers in Earth embodiment. And a few of these guys told me, who had broken through their MK Ultra mind control programming, that they remember one day, now they remember actually being on the Merkaba light ship in the Federation, coming on a mission to infiltrate the dark side, to become a whistleblower. And so in those days, it was really interesting meeting these guys here. So here's Manabai, and then we had Terry Cassidy and Project Camelot and people you've interviewed, and David Wilcock, all these different people who come out. I heard similar stories from people who would show up, because these guys had changed their identity a number of times, and they looked me right in the eye and they told me these stories and felt like I could get this information out since I was alive, since the cabal off me, here I'm still alive to tell the story. And over and over, and hearing these stories again, so it's been fascinating. And of course, then Well, I'm on board, and I meet Corton in the second experience, an old friend who, you know, again, I remember hanging out with him in the councils, and he's a communication specialist, and he's overshadowed all my channeling classes since that time. And he told me two of the statements, really, I always like to emphasize this, because up until experience in 79, all my sessions, my readings were very karmic. But I always knew I was supposed to do sessions for other volunteers. So Corton specifically emphasizes to me, he said, from now on, the sessions you will be doing will be for others like yourself, and they're going to be transformational. And it was interesting because when I watched them, when I left my body at one point, I'm looking down and they've taken the blood out of my body and they put it in kind of this, kind of a container. It was, I say oil and water slushing around, it's kind of the effect. And they were changing my DNA RNA. Right. And so they explained to me later, because that experience of being hit with the beam and ripping the life force out of me, and this is a very horrendous, I mean, I can talk about it now because I'm very detached from it, but that is a negative experience. Sometimes a negative experience ends up being actually a blessing.
Sure.
Because they explained to me that this encodement change in my DNA RNA allowed them now to channel in, and that's when I'm doing these sessions and Astra and the various things are channeling through me. They have an energy beam on me from the Merkaba light ship on a higher dimension, and they're downloading what's called these higher light encodements. Now, this is what I find, I have to say, I find this very fascinating. All these years of, because in 1979 on, after thousands of sessions, as years passed, I lost count how many sessions I've actually done. But they always, everyone has to go through a cosmic security code, kind of, to connect with me or do an event. So they explained to me that this encodement, this DNA RNA change, allowed me to channel through my DNA RNA the encodements. Because it was kind of like a modern day initiation in the mystery schools when they would pass on the power, pass on the sword. So this allowed them through this experience to protect me against that kind of attack, but it was also allowing them to download these things.
So, does that mean there are some people you won't do channelings for?
Put it this way, people are not drawn to get a session from me.
I totally
unless,
get that, yeah.
And Ashtar always talks about, there's always a couple requirements he mentions during the session about how much karma has been balanced out, and he always refers to this harmonic frequency scale, where are you vibrating on that scale? And there's a minimum frequency that a person has to be vibrating on in order to connect them. You have the desire to connect.
I agree. With my essences and alchemy.
Yeah.
I totally understand
right.
that. Mm-hmm. So, okay, back to you getting taken out and off.
Yes.
Okay, and then they did this thing, and they mixed your blood, and you came back, and how long did it take for you to kind of, did you realize right away when you came back to planet Earth that this had happened to you?
Because when they beamed me back, and then, you know, and then, of course, I was aware, and you know, I'm remembering everything was happening on the ship. One of the interesting things, and they warned me too, they said, hey, if you move too fast, your blood and I felt my blood running through my veins. About 30 days, about a month goes by, and all of a sudden, I didn't feel anymore, and I felt stronger. It was like my body was assimilating and being conditioned. Yeah. And so it was just interesting at that point. Now, as things have happened after that experience, and when I bounced back, and of course, you know, I'm the kind of person, I have to push the envelope a little bit sometimes. You know, I just have to, you know. Well, and people often ask me, how are you doing? And my response sometimes is, well, about as good as you can be on Earth without being illegal or immoral. But pushing the envelope, of course, okay. I always say, you have to have a good sense of humor. I always say, you got to have to get heavy and light at the same time. And I tell people, Astor says this too, if you don't have a good sense of galactic street smarts, and you're not heavy and light at the same time, and a good sense of humor, you might as well throw the towel in being down here. But
I so agree. I think like for the Guardians, we're really intense.
Yeah.
But we like to have a lot of fun.
We like to have a lot of fun.
You know.
So of course, a few days when I come back from the experience, and I'm talking to a woman over the phone, and I thought, having talked to all these guys, you know, about how our phone conversations are being monitored, and NSA, you know, they have voice phonetic activation, you say words. So I love to say certain words to the computer, you know, start smoking. So I was talking to this woman on the phone, and I decided to let go. I just let him, I said, you know what, the Space Brothers are pissed off. They're going to bomb the White House. Now, and I'm in this conversation. Now, and I could pick up that all these agencies are freaking out because of what I said, but nobody approached me. Nobody approached me directly. And so years later, and I'm always meeting people from various agencies, and I had moved from, I had been living in, later on when I was living in Arizona, Phoenix, Arizona, and I ended up moving to Florida in the late 90s. And I went to an event, a series of events in Fort Lauderdale, and one of the events at the hotel, I don't know, 100 people showed up or something, and the guy sitting in the front row, and he comes up to me afterwards and introduces himself that he was in the Secret Service back in 1979. And I shared my experience. They said, that was very interesting. He said, because my superiors informed me that we thought we were going to be attacked from space. Now, I just remember what was interesting, that 2 months after, going back in 79, March 25th of 79, when I had the experience, I read in more than one paper, this was actually, they published this, that the White House was concerned about possible terrorist activity, and they were going to install a special missile system. I'm thinking to myself, is this coincidence? Where the areas no coincidences? Was it public disclosure or black op, a disclosure that got out accidentally? And so the Secret Service guy said, well, we're thinking of either getting these handheld little rocket launcher things or some other kind of thing. But the fact that, he had heard that they were concerned about it because obviously they were monitoring and obviously picked it up. So that kind of stuff. Well, interesting talking about how, the government was, they couldn't handle it, that they couldn't off me. And so later, after the National Enquirer did an article on my ex and I, and it was in August of 1982, on the third page, and it said, this Scottsdale couple claims to be from outer space, inquiring, and they showed me back, remember in the TV, they used to do this whole thing for a whole week, and inquiring minds want to know, for a whole week, they broadcast this thing about me, my ex. So, and we had gone, I'd gone to Las Vegas, Shirley MacLaine had sponsored us for a workshop there, actually, and so we had gone on one of our first lecture tours. Now, this is going to bring in something else here. And I went all over the United States on several different lecture tours. From 1981, 82, we did quite a few. All of a sudden, almost overnight, all these, I would call them all these well-known names. They became well-known quite quickly in the UFO community. People like different people like Bill Moore, Stanton Friedman, Jamie Sandra, eventually people like Bud Hopkins, all these people suddenly start, the UFO community starts to become, let's just say they became quite organized in one sense from the original flying saucer movement. And flying saucer was the term that when, when they had sighting, they had met a number of sightings and, they referred to them as flying saucers or discs. So that term got caught in people's mind. And Arnold, so there was a lot of sightings in regard to that kind of thing. But in the early years, people like Georgia Dempsey, George Van Tassel, all these people, I really feel they were the pioneers. They really, because I'm on this lecture tour talking about human appearing beings. And I had been getting a hold of the Billy Myers contact, which was the most documented case in UFO history, human appearing beings from the Pleiades, coming here, and people like Wendell Stevens, who I got to know, and Jim Delatoso, who did all the computer analysis, actually had a center in Phoenix, and a big shopping center there, and NASA gave him equipment and stuff, and he was developing new components. He was a, a child prodigy kind of person. And so they gave him all this stuff, and he developed all these very advanced techniques to analyze and verify photographs and 8mm film. Wow. And, of course, organizations like MUFON, who sprang up, who come off like they're, the ultimate investigative group. Well, when you find out people like Walt Andrews, who started it, who was in the NSA, it was kind of like when NICAP, National Aeronautics, National Investigation Committee Aerial Phenomena, later said they got infiltrated by the CIA. This was a group in the 1950s, and Aerial Research and APRO. These groups got taken away. Well, MUFON from the get-go was really started by the government, pretending to be this group of researchers investigating some big mystery and finding out why. It was interesting years later when I was going on some lecture tours and this guy Duncan Cameron came up during the New York at the Whole Life Expo and looks at all the documentation I have on my desk. Next thing you know, you have the Nexus publication that came out. I mean, I wasn't in a position to do a publication. It was great that he could do it, but he got his idea from all the stuff that I had on the table. And some of the early issues were based on some of that stuff. And he interviewed this guy, who mentioned George Hunt Williamson, who had been, you know, who was a friend of George Adamski, and he talked about how they tried to recruit him. Because, and he, of course, he didn't want to be recruited to become involved in some classified project. This is why when I was going through school, I just goofed off. And I know if I had applied myself and got straight, you know, A's, they would have tried to recruit me also probably to classified projects. But I bring this up because the guy, I forget his name, but he was dying of cancer. And he had been in military intelligence. And he says, there is an organization in the U.S., and he was in Australia, I believe, who's up to it, and the person in charge of it is up to his butt in the cabal. He was talking about MUFON and Walt Andrews. Very obvious.
I want to add to that. It has been determined by some research, and very good research and a lot of details, that most, if not all, of the contactees, there's many contactees that have gone to MUFON because they're freaked out, right? They start realizing that they're getting harassed, astrally raped.
Yep.
Horrifically abducted, my lab, you know, if it's my lab, then it's military involved.
Yeah.
So it's not the good guys. It's not our true galactic brothers and sisters. And they're determining now very succinctly that there is a connection between from the time that they go and they seek help out with MUFON, and they are almost immediately, within a very short period of time, my labbed.
Well, it's interesting. I was at one of the conferences. I would go there because, even though they wouldn't allow me to speak because I'm part of the lunatic friends, remember?
Right.
But they wouldn't mind taking my money for a booth. So I would be there to do my little cosmic hors d'oeuvre, 15-minute, half-hour readings, and then later set up the longer ones. And the people would show up all the time, come up to my booth, and they'd say, I don't even know why I'm at this conference. And then they look and connect with me, and they go, you're the person, because I would be doing these transformational sessions, which is totally different, you know, the spiritual stuff that I was talking about. And it was all the time I was picking up all this stuff going on. And one of the conferences, they boldly were talking about how they had just all been abducted the night before, almost like they were proud of it, like they enjoyed it, getting stuff stuck up their butts and all the stuff that they did. And at one point, somebody was talking about, like, who seemed to be concerned about it and said, I don't know what to do about all this abduction stuff. I said, why don't you call in the human appearing beings to intervene and stop it? You know, and the person was acting like he was concerned when I said that. It was like, oh, well, like they pretended they wanted to solve some of the problem. But when you say something very simple and come, they didn't want to really acknowledge how obvious it was about, you know, how they were covering up one particular group of beings that was a major part of the group beings coming here. I mean, there were different species, and on it, because a being looks different, makes them negative or positive. But the fact that the human appearing beings are major as far as the beginning of the human race and what role they play. Well, so as time went on, and you know, and of course the Billy Myers case being the most documented case, MUFON never wanted to acknowledge it. Well, and I knew Wendell Stevens, and there was a couple called the Elders, Britton Lee Elder. When Shirley MacLaine sponsored me in Las Vegas, and we went and we were actually guests for her at her hotel there, and we watched her do her show and everything. And so we're sitting at the table, and Brittany Elder came up, and they gave my ex and I a cold shoulder, like we had a virus or something. And I had never met them, even though I knew Wendell and Jim. So anyway, and Shirley MacLaine asked me all these questions. She was concerned about her career if she came out with a book, and also, yeah, would ruin her career. And I said, no, they're going to bless you, you know, for you to come out on that, published
that
out on the list.
She totally was a trailblazer.
Yeah, and so then, so as time went on, and then Jim won in 1985, and we were at a party, and they had been having this problem according to distribution rights. And Wendell went over to Switzerland, and in the film called Contact in the Pleiades, which was the most documented case in UFO history, and they were supposed to come out with 6 volumes of photographs. They only published 2 of them. And then they were having arguments about who had distribution rights because different people had supposedly funded that. And Lynn went over there. Anyway, so one day, one evening, and we were there at a party, and Jim came up and dropped a copy of Contact from the Pleiades film in my lap. He said, Merry Christmas. Now, he didn't say to me, be careful where you show it. Well, I went over to Europe, to Britain. I showed it at Hawaii at the university there, and the officials really freaked out. Because here was a contact with human-appearing, benevolent beings, with a contactee, unlike all the abduction stuff. And even though all the film, all the photographs in 8mm film were computer authenticated with top NASA equipment. That Jim did all this. He developed all these very advanced techniques to verify they weren't cutouts, they weren't models, they weren't anything that you could do at that time. And also there was a thing called a sound bank. Rundle took the sounds of the ship, which Billy Myers recorded while it was hovering overhead, to the sound bank that has every known sound on Earth. And he could not identify some of the sounds that the ship was emitting. Now, there was a thing that was being emitted called the Schumann resonance. Billy Myers said the ship's right in the magnetic field, and those frequencies were present. And there's the old, where's the proof, where's the beat? Well, Sam Jossi, one of his Palladian female contacts, gave him these crystal metal samples. And in the film, Contacting the Pleiades, Marcel Vogel, who passed away a few years ago, he is the top, at that time, he was the top crystal metal analysis expert in the world. Right. And he analyzed them on film. You see him at IBM Research Laboratory analyzing them and going, there's no way we can develop this or produce or develop this on Earth, present levels of Earth technology, because it's a cold fusion process of both crystal and metal, over 60
wow.
elements. Now, again, and here was the ultimate thing, but MUFON still did not want to recognize it. Well, a few years later, because MUFON wanted to get a hold of the computer techniques that Jim had developed, and it was interesting because in Phoenix, at the MUFON local chapter, they finally begrudgingly had to invite Jim Del Toso to go to it. And finally, they're acknowledging, begrudgingly, the Billy Myers contact case, okay? And there's a lot of interesting, you know, politics going on about the whole thing. And it was basically they didn't want to recognize a bona fide contact case, the most documented case of all the evidence. And if you go to Georgia Dampsey's contact, he was also giving crystal metal samples that was analyzed at a laboratory. But by the time he got back to the guy had been gotten to and the government basically told, and then he pretended that there was nothing unusual about the samples. Okay, things like that, and Kodak actually analyzed a lot of his photos, and they said, you know, verified it, but then, of course, they tried to, you know, change the story later.
How long has MUFON been around?
I forget. I think they came in the 80s. I forget exactly the whole story. I just know that Walt Andrews started, and he was from the NSA, and...
Hello.
And then, of course, I'll just share this because when we were, after the National Enquirer interviewed us, all of a sudden all the corporate mainstream media wanted to interview me and my ex. And so we did, I mean.
Because you got this document.
Yeah. Well, we got a hold of declassified information. Okay. And I had the computer analyze photos and I would present that information first. And then I would go into the more metaphysical stuff. So they were kind of begrudgingly had to kind of be a little open to what I was sharing. Well, when in 82, we were in Detroit and we went to New York and we were staying at the hotel there. And it had three levels to it. And I can't remember the name of the hotel. It was one of the many hotels we've stayed at during our lecture tours. And so we were getting ready to go to an interview and forgot some documentation. So my ex goes and...
Okay, everyone. Well, for some reason, the interview got cut off right in the middle, and so we had to kind of retake it, which is why you're seeing a change in the recording lighting. So anyway, we left off, Michael, with you just talking about the documents that were presented to you, and I think you left off right where you were in New York, right?
Well, actually, we were in Detroit. My ex was I went into the elevator to get some documentation. I forgot to bring with us initially for this media interview. She goes and gets us in the elevator, and there's two guys standing in there with their briefcases acting like she's not there. You know, you've been in elevators where the door opens and closes and unless the person's visible. So they're talking about their surveillance equipment, coffee and donuts, and just like at the airport and everything, and there's only three levels to our hotel. Well, you know, so she goes up and gets off at our level to get the documentation, but there's only one more level. So later on, she goes on a couple errands and a couple of cars follow her, and she does these maneuvers and they do the same thing, and so finally she comes back to the hotel and says, I got to do a channeling and find out. Well, you know, I tuned in that the agents are in the room above, right above us. And Monka, Space Brother Monka, was coming through me, and he channels through me and says, I want to introduce myself to two agents in the room above. He says, we in the Federation are very loving, peaceful beings, but we don't like our emissaries being harassed. Ever heard of the wrath of the gods? And they just silent for a few moments. I can imagine what they were thinking. And so nothing much came out after that. Well, we go into New York about a month later, and we have the experience of interacting with Mrs. Hemsley. Remember the Queen of Mean, as she was known? And she ended up throwing us out of her hotel because we were getting too many calls about our event that we were planning at the Hemsley Harley. Well, we ended up moving to the Scottsdale Sheridan, I mean the New York Sheridan, but she refused to forward any of our calls. It kind of financially devastated us. So, one thing I would mention too is I was sitting there as we're getting right before we left the Avenue of Americas, Fifth Avenue, looking down, and I noticed this big building. The big Tishman building. It was a big black building with red neon letters, 666, which is the address. I thought, man, it pays to advertise who owns New York. And that was the, you know, the, well, the 666 has been referred to as the Mark of the Beast. It's a negative aspect of things. And I tuned in that she had a lot of heavy karma. And sure enough, a number of years later, the reptilians eat their own, kind of. They'll use their own, because there was a big sovereign movement starting to occur. People starting to challenge the corrupt judicial system, you know, about starting on the alien rights. And of course, now that Laura and I have become involved in the National Liberty Alliance, NLA, and literally in the last year, carpet bombing the officials with millions of documents to challenge the corrupt judicial system, which is freaking them out, really. Mm-hmm. We've been a lot of intel, you know, back of, you know, a number of people, white hats way up in intel, telling us, hey, you're doing a great job, yeah. Keep up the good work. Well, no organization has ever done this before. We have over 5,000 members. So, and I was told two years ago when we got involved in the National Liberty Alliance, Ashtar told me, this is bringing back the common law grand jury, that this would become the planetary council to connect with the galactic council. And I would highly recommend check out NLA, and maybe that's one of the reasons the whole thing didn't work earlier.
Laura's my next interview.
So. Right. So maybe I just needed to just plug that.
But anyway,
we're getting ready to leave New York, and, you know, and sometimes you look back and experience and say, wait a minute. What, you know, you remember something you didn't initially remember. Well, as I remembered, you know, when my ex had gone in, we stopped at a building, and she went in to get some food. And later I realized there were two MIBs standing by the car. And these guys, they had their guns in their, you know, their hands in their coats, kind of like super glued. And man, talk about, and I was told later this was Rothschild's assassination squad that he had sent, kind of guys that don't mess up on their mission. But that particular day, man, I wouldn't want to be in their shoes getting your butt reamed out when they said, well, my hand was, you know, was super glued to my breast.
So they basically prevented them from being able to pull
right.
their hand
out. Right, but it was just another one of those attempts upon me. And it was another, and even years later, when after they realized they couldn't off me and they just screwed with my emails and phone calls, I thought, first I got irritated. I thought, wait a minute, if I'm not much of a threat, I must be doing something right. So I appreciate their tender, loving care that they'd go out of their way to screw with me. And I would say that. I'd say, I just can't tell you how much I appreciate your validation. I just appreciate that so much. They don't know how to deal with humor. See, and I never had any fear about it. But anyway, then, you know, jumping three years later, when my ex and I were kind of sponsored by the BBC, we went over to Britain, even though we contacted a couple groups, UFO groups, and there's no interest over here. Well, Ashtar tells us, go over there. And so we go there, and we had return tickets, but days, weeks go by, and finally we're one more day, and we're going to be on the money, and we have to come back. And I started a channeling, and Ashtar comes through and says, do you think we've sent you over here to have your tail between your legs and you have to come back? So the next day we make this connection. And this guy does rebirthing over there. Well, you know, and he asked us how he could help us, and we hadn't made any connections really at that point. And I said, well, could you arrange some events? Well, he arranged a couple events, and within less than a week we had a few thousand dollars that had been manifested through the readings and work I was doing. And it was interesting because I connected with one guy there who actually had been a member of some of these Illuminati groups, and he left. Now, it was incredible that he was able to leave. He was in connected. He got into the Skull and Bones, the Tridal Commission, the Council for all these different groups, and he was telling me all about this experience. And it was just, and he was married to this British woman. So anyway, so we ended up. Later, so when we got the money, we were able to, we were guided to go in this kind of grid work over to Italy. And the, of course, the British intelligence was trying to kill us or take our money, you know, because they broke into our van twice. It was the same left window, too, you know, they'd steal our resources or kill us. Like one time point, somebody got in and turned on the gas in the Volkswagen van, and my ex was smoking. We should have burst into a fireball. And another time, so they stole some money. Well, you know, they assumed, well, they don't have any connections over there. Well, because I have people I'm doing readings for who have some connections, like one person whose brother-in-law, this guy I just mentioned, was a banker. And we had this break-in. We call up and told him, and he goes, how much money do you need? Well, I ended up, of course, paying him back when he did the Body, Mind, Spirit Festival. But because I was able to do that, allowed us to continue to travel.
Sure.
These are the things that the intelligence did not really, they didn't, they really couldn't relate to.
Totally blew them away.
We were having all these connections and contact. If I knew they were in Rome at this, and we were hanging out in Rome at this, at the Café du Paris, which is right across from the Skelser Hotel. And it's, and I didn't know this at the time, that it was a hangout for international agents. I wonder why they were all dressed really good and they spoke all these different languages, but they were particularly fascinated and interested in my exes and my ET UFO experiences. So they're asking all these questions, and we kind of made it clear we're going to be there for quite a while. Now, my ex's a son from a former marriage, he had come over from Detroit. You know, he was like 15, looks a lot older than he was, and I was looking actually younger than my age. And so, but anyway, he had to fly back to Detroit. And so he gets back and he hears on the news that Café du Paris was blown up and 55 people killed, hundreds probably injured. And he was freaking out because, you know, it took us 2 weeks before we got back to London. When we had the second break-in, we were in the Sistine Chapel admiring God, same left window. They got through that. Yeah. So I got bummed out and said, okay, let's go back to Britain. Well, we had made them, you know, at the Café du Paris, we told them we're going to be coming back. Well, we found out later that the higher forces created a hologram of my ex and I. That hologram arrived at the Café du Paris, and that's when they blew it up. And they thought they had offed us. So then when we popped back up in London, and it was like, they just didn't, they could never understand when they tried to off, you know, when they tried to kill me in 79 and then in 82 and now in 85. I was like, you know, don't you guys, don't you ever, you know, I know it's the robot against the wall, but they just don't quite comprehend how could we be doing all this stuff, accomplish all we, you know, when in their minds, they just couldn't conceive of the connections. Well, anyway, so those were things that really confirmed to me, I mean, over and over again, how much, you know, how much cosmic backup team watching our backside. Now, you know,
and so much of that's so foreign to them because it's not the way they function, because it's so much on a physical level, right?
Yes, and so you know, I mentioned this. You know, I think I mentioned some of it earlier relating to. You know, or having connected with a number of the early contactees, and of course they went through a number of incredible challenges. Well, it's interesting, you know, in regard to, you know, the original flying saucer conventions that took place. You know, George Van Tassel, who I got to know, you know, quite a bit now in the late 70s, which was kind of interesting. He, of course, was the one who put together all the flying saucer conventions, and that was, you know, people like George Adamski, Howard Menger, Arlie Lanchusi, all the original pioneers. The ones that I consider, you know, the contactees and the people of that day who first had contact with human-appearing beings, and they referred to themselves as the Space Brothers, the space people, the boys' top side. And it was, and now, of course, I also enjoy it when David Wilcox talked about how the government, you know, military, you know, had many, many times attempted to send a missile, launch a missile, and all the bolts that were holding the missile together was all laying around on the ground. And sometimes they would turn those bolts into flowers. Now, David Woodcock made the comment, you know, he said that his insiders said that, the military is pissed off, and they said, those damn hippies from outer space? Astor tells me, he said, we were proud of that title, those damn hippies from outer space. So they did those kind of things, and, well, anyway, so George Van Tassel was, you know, the first one to channel Astor in July 18th, 1952. Did I mention this experience earlier in the first
I don't know, but okay. It's okay.
Well, this
have
is,
to forgive us,
yeah,
everybody.
This is a very significant event that happened because, you know, in when And I also refer to the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still, not the remake, the recent one, but the one in 1950, Michael Rainey, who played the space brother Klaatu.
If you haven't seen it, make sure you see it.
Now, what's interesting about that movie is in the final scene when Michael Rainey, the space brother Klaatu, comes out and steps and on the ramp of the ship as they're getting ready to take off, what he said, actually what he channeled, about how if you take your negativity other places, we will stop you. Well, that really was not part of the original script. He actually channeled that scene, and they went ahead and used that scene
in
the movie. And there was a couple instances in the movie also where, the Klaatu is, dressed incognito in Earth clothes, but he befriended the little boy because he has this boarding house room that he's rented since he landed his ship on the White House lawn. And so they're walking among the crowd, and the media comes up to him and said, "What do you think about this?" And he goes, "What I don't like to see is hysteria, is common sense replaced with hysteria." Well, the media moves away. They don't want to hear that. And then there was a moment when he was attempting, connecting with one of the scientists, trying to attempt to get everybody organized to have a meeting, to connect with everybody. And the scientist says, "Well, that's going to be a lot of problems because there's all, have all this bureaucracy." And he goes, "I don't care about your petty squabbles." Meaning, it was like, that's what Ashtar told me, because, when Ashtar first channeled through George Van Tassel, and that was July 18, 1952. And it was one of a series of channeling messages he got that day. And he would do his channelings underneath Giant Rock, which was a big boulder there when he purchased Giant Rock Airport back in the late 40s. And he started doing these flying saucer conventions. So he channeled Ashtar and the different beings for a number of years there. And so on July 18, 1952, that was, as I said, the first date that Ashtar in the modern age came through. And then he started coming through other contacts and channels later on. But he made it clear in that initial channeling that they were going to put on a little benevolent show of force. 24 hours later, July 19th, and repeated the 26th, and you go to the headlines and newspapers, and you'll see flying saucers over the White House, flying saucers over the Capitol building. And, of course, the modern UFO community would have us believe that was just a bunch of, because the Nazis did, at the end of World War II, Joseph Farrell is even one of the researchers who verified this, that the Nazis actually developed anti-gravity. And if the war had not ended when it did, 2 weeks later, it would have ended entirely different. Of course, my perception is that we're in a new timeline, that in the old timeline, that the Axis did in fact win, just like in the Civil War, the South won. And when we all came back in time, we changed the timeline, so history was changed. Of course, the sense of that changing the traditional view of history as it's been reported to us is somewhat distorted by the power elite, leaving out a lot of things like the Nazis' development of technology and a lot of other things. And when they dropped the bomb at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, those were actually German bombs, because the Americans were not far enough along in the Manhattan Project. They weren't, but they would make us believe they were.
Sure.
But it was actually, and Colonel Wendell Stevens and other researchers I've connected with have documented that fact. But anyway, the point about the flyover of the nation's capital, these UFO, so-called professional UFO investigators, as they tried to call themselves, and referring to the original pioneers and contactees as a lunatic fringe to debunk, to ridicule those that were talking about spiritual things. The human-appearing beings, even though there's many different species out there that will eventually be landing here, the vast majority and the ones that will be coming at first are totally human-appearing. Even David Wilcock, through his contacts, said there's at least 55 minimum different beings that are human-appearing. Some are so human you would not even tell. Some are slightly different. Some are a little bit different. But the fact is that they can walk incognito down on Earth, and I've met a few of them in years past. And then during the 19th...
They have, different colored skin and different colored eyes.
There's actually races of that are human appearing that are blue and green and purple. I mean, literally the rainbow race is real. Yeah. And there's so many different species out there. But anyway, getting back to the Day the Earth Stood Still and the flyover, the reason I refer to that movie in that scene of when he said, "I don't care about your petty situations," Ashtar told me that when they appeared over the nation's capital, and I've talked to military pilots who knew other pilots who have tried to chase the UFOs, tried to chase the flying saucers, and they flew rings around the planes. So he said that they, and I've met out of the 200 to 300 people, guys that have been on the Black Op Alpha Soup agencies, I would say there was probably four of them that I specifically remember who had top secret clearance. Now, Robert Dean, who also had top secret clearance, he was working with NATO, but these guys also had it, and they said that these beings projected images of themselves. They were human appearing. They referred to the fact that they belonged to the Federation. These were not Nazis, okay?
Right.
And plus, would you think higher forces would allow a bunch of fascist Nazis to do that flyover because it was such a major historical event? I mean, come on. That's what the UFO researchers, quote unquote, you know, who I have no respect for because they want to debunk and ridicule all the early pioneers because, again, that was the spiritual thing that the early pioneers are really focusing on. And then one of the...
And the positive extraterrestrials that they weren't here to hurt us.
Right. At some point, we'll maybe do another presentation about the fact that there was a huge amount of communication with ham radios and radio telegraphy and Morse code, and as well as channeling during the 1950s and 60s. And there was a famous book that's out of print called The Saucers Speak, published by George Hunt Williamson. That's a very fascinating story, you know, that of what was going on that they've covered up and tried to, you know, put it underneath a cover. Well, anyway, so Asher says he wanted to come down, and because of the bureaucracy and all the difficulties, it took him 2 years before the Earth officials would finally agree to allow them to land, and that was in February 20th and 21st, 1954.
Amazing.
Now, that's the event. Very famous event relative to the fact that, you know, President Eisenhower, the official story is that he was at the dentist. That darn tooth cap, darn it, it came loose again. Oh, my God. Oh, it's so painful also. God, he was so long he was at the dentist, a day or two. Man, he was a long
so
visit
silly.
At the dentist. You know, and it was interesting because there was a guy named Gerald Light who taught metaphysical classes, he taught out-of-body experiences, and he was representing the metaphysical community. What would happen is the officials had invited various different people, like Cardinal McIntyre, representing the Catholic Church, to be there. There was people from the newspapers, various different people, and Gerald Light, of course, being very spiritual, and he was very attuned, and he tuned into all these military people that were standing around, and said their ego was so threatened by, you know, after they had, well, of course, I understand they had just fought this big war a few years earlier, and here suddenly the, you know, these beings are landing. After they finally allowed for them to come down. And, of course, Edwards Air Force Base, also known as Morrick Field, prior to that. So three light ships landed on the tarmac there. And these beings, and a lot of them wore very long hair in those days. They referred to themselves as the Aetherians. They stepped out in their metallic jumpsuits and interacted with the, you know, the military and everybody there. Now, Ashtar has told me, he said,
where was this?
This was Edwards Air Force Base.
Edwards, and it was 1954?
1954, February 20th and 21st.
Interesting. Okay.
And Ashtar said to me, he goes, I knew they were going to turn us down, but we had to put them through, you know, intergalactic protocol to present to them. So that later when things got out of hand with the Greys, they couldn't say they hadn't been forewarned. Because what they did when they landed is they presented to the officials that they said, we would like to give your people some very advanced technology that would transform your planet into the golden age. But in order to do that, I know you're not going to misuse it, and also you have a benevolent intent, we want you to relinquish all your thermonuclear warheads as a gesture of peace and tell everybody in the planet what the options were. Well, we had a little thing called the National Security Act that had been forced on us. The people didn't vote on that. The military-industrial complex forced it on us. Now, right there, under National Liberty Alliance, if the people didn't vote on it, hey, that should never have been. There are so many statutes and codes and things that are executive orders forced on us, and that's one thing I'm exciting about National Liberty Alliance, that we are going to, which are going to become the Planetary Council, we're going to force the officials to get rid of all laws, all statutes, all codes. Because under common law, there's no victim, there's no crime. That's a simple, that's galactic law, that's common law, that's, you know, natural law, common sense laws. Well, anyway, so they said this, you know, if you'll relinquish your thermonuclear words and tell everybody what the options are, we'll give you this. Well, they didn't want to do it. And then they said, okay, we want to warn you about another group orbiting at the equator. And those were called the Greys. Now, William Cooper, wrote the book Behold a Pale Horse, who I really supported very much. He was uncomfortable with me because I'm talking about Ashtar, and he was a little more traditional religious way. But still, I was one of his biggest supporters, so he couldn't really, you know, he was trying to be very frightened. He was an ex-naval intelligence officer. Well, you know, he exposed in the book, there's two or three pages in Behold a Pale Horse, the book, that exposes the whole UFO community. And all these people, he mentioned that there were these lists he saw when he was in naval intelligence, people that were from civilian level and military level that was going to be recruited, like overnight become suddenly a UFO expert and put out to present what the government wanted them to know. And even people like Jenny Randles, who, you know, she used to be a man, but she became a woman because she wanted to be have a sex change operation. And the government, British government said, okay, we'll pay for a sex change operation if you will become an expert, a UFO, quote, UFO expert, present what we want you to share.
Now, and when did Bill put this book out?
Behold a Pale Horse came out in, I'm trying to remember. It was late 80s, early 90s when it came out.
And he was taken out when?
He was taken out in, around right after 9/11.
Interesting.
And he was ambushed in Arizona.
Yeah, I remember that story.
Yeah, and so he said, but see,
he knew that.
Yeah, well, he was kind of coming from a point he said, you know, like the ones that say they won't take my gun till they pry from my cold, still fingers. He was very much into the Second Amendment and, you know, believing that we have unalienable rights and that we must protect those. And, I mean, I'm looking forward to a world of peace, but you can't legislate by outlawing certain weapons because criminals will always have them. I mean, this is just a common sense thing. In every society where they outlaw the use of firearms, they become a fascist society. Now, I'm very much into peace. I'm a rainbow warrior, and the mind is the biggest weapon of all. But to me, you know, we have to use a little common sense and discernment. All these false flags that are going on right now with crisis actors. I mean, this is happening after 9/11, amazing, which was a big wake-up call. And, somebody who I just connected recently, Dr. Joe, who knows a crisis actor, and she's kind of a little embarrassed about it, but there are these people doing this because, well, they don't know what else to do. They're being paid for it, and sometimes they get manipulated into doing it, too. That's another story, but I wanted to focus on right now, getting back to George Van Tassel. This is a very fascinating story. I had gone out there and got to know George in the late 70s, and 1967 was the last major conference that he had until 1970. Well, he just kind of quit it for a while because he did it every year, and he just felt he needed to take a break a little bit.
Was the only one that did it.
Yeah, he was the only one to put together a conference that would allow all the contactees from all over the world, like George Adamski and Howard Menger and all these kinds of people, to have a place they could go and speak. And, of course, we figured that probably a third to half of the people were government agents walking around updating their files and everybody. But so... He was building a device called the Integratron. This is a wooden, huge dome building, and there was no metal in it. And that was one of his missions, to build this device that would be a huge rejuvenator where 100,000 people would go through it.
Yeah, he was visited by a Venusian that gave him the blueprints.
Right. Uh-huh. He had a number of contacts where he was gone for days, and Doris, his wife, got used to it.
That's crazy.
And so... Well, in 1977, he was 99% completed. Now, he built this based on donations, and just by donations, all he got. And so at this point, he'd already began to have experiences with the Black Ops hiding up in the hills and, you know, playing spy versus spy games, and they threatened him and told him that they're going to off him and his family if he completed it. And you can imagine, you know, when he built originally the smaller model and put a lizard in that, who had his tail cut off, and within a few minutes it grew back a tail. So he said, all I have to do is build a bigger one. Well, the AMA and the medical the mafia, as I like to call them, the dark alchemists, they don't want, you know, people to be really healthy. You know, imagine 100,000 people going through that and being healed and rejuvenated. Oh, my God. Talk about all the profit that they would be out of. So here he is in this dilemma.
The war money that we
gave away. And he didn't know what he was going to do. He didn't want to let Doris, his wife, know. He didn't want her to worry about it. Well, and I kind of picked up that he was getting ready to be taken off the planet physically because he'd done all he could do. And so I get the kind of word through the cosmic grapevine. Ashtar tells me that they're getting ready to take him. And then I hear this message that he had had a heart attack and died. Ashtar says, nope, he's not really dead. That's just a cover story. So I go to the memorial service, this closed coffin memorial service.
You got to see it for yourself, right?
Right. And
And he's projecting to me spiritually going, he's really alive, everything's cool. But he said, I can't tell you all the story right now. I'll tell you later. And there was always a reason why he sometimes delay.
Yeah.
And I was to find out why this was so I could experience certain things that the story would then be, the rest of it would be shared with me and had more significance because I waited. And
right.
That's how it is sometimes, as much as we went out. Oh, give me the whole enchilada right now. Like an 8-course dinner. I can. And Doris was acting kind of like, she wasn't really seeming upset about the fact that her husband had died. And she was just acting matter of fact. She had friends from out of town. She was just kind of conducting everybody to do whatever they needed to do. So I left that afternoon. I wish I had stayed longer at what had happened that evening. Well, several years go by and I ended up moving to Phoenix, Arizona. And we started doing these round robin things where Ashtar and Monka and different beings would channel through me. You know, like 30, 40 people show up in my townhouse there in Scottsdale. And it was only by word of mouth. And so I would go around town and put up flyers. And one day I went to this newsstand. It doesn't exist now, but it existed then. Put up a flyer, and as I pulled into the parking lot, I see this guy leaning against a car there. And what I didn't know was he had just pulled up a few minutes before I pulled in there, and had driven all the way from Yucca Village. George Van Tassel's property had been told a story by Doris Van Tassel, his wife, that she had told very few people, and then said to him, now you're to take this, you know, and go to Phoenix, Arizona, and you're going to connect with somebody, I don't know who, and you're going to, you have to share this story with them. So I didn't know this guy from Adam, but he's leaning there, and I suddenly get this message telepathically that I need to invite him to the event. So I go over and say, interested in metaphysics? His eyes kind of lit up. He said, yeah. I say, well, I'm doing this, you know, channeling thing, and you're invited to go. Well, later that evening, and I don't know if Monka was coming through me a lot in those days, had never mentioned maybe in passing sign of time about the interpreter, but he turns to the guy, starts talking in depth about George Van Tassel and why they couldn't complete the interpreter. I don't remember everything he said because it's so many years later. And so after it was over and I came back to consciousness, and the guy said, well, he said, let me tell you a story. He said, when you pulled up in the parking lot there, he said, I had just driven off the Interstate 10 freeway a few minutes before, felt a strong guidance to pull in there because I had just driven 6 to 7 hours from having met with Doris Van Tassel, George Van Tassel's wife, who told me this interesting story. And so then he tells me the story. Going back to 1977. When that memorial service happened, and of course she had friends from family from out of town, and so they were sleeping their sleeping bags all over the mobile home. And so when they turned off the light, and a few minutes later, they were getting ready to go to sleep, they heard this loud pinging sound. At least that's like, they turn on the light and they look around. Well, they didn't look close enough at the piece of petrified wood over by the parking, over by the fireplace. You know how hard petrified wood is. Mm-hmm. Well, here's this perfect heart shape. The pinging sound was the sound from the laser coming down from the ship from George Van Tassel to say to his wife, I still loved her. Now, you know what? I just forgot part of the story. Okay. You know, this was important. This was significant. It's kind of hilarious, too, okay? Because George was very devoted to Doris, but he would flirt with the ladies.
Right.
And they would say, oh, there's George flirting again. It was nothing serious. He just loved to, you know, joke with them and everything. So this thing of flirting with the ladies was kind of a little saying, you know, around George a little bit. And that's why when, you know, George had been gone for a while one day, longer than normal, and Doris is starting to wonder, and she gets a knock at the door, a mobile home, and she goes over and opens it up, and there's these three. They look like off-duty Earth models, but they're all dressed in their jumpsuits from the ship. And they go, oh, we had to take George with us because we have work to do with him, you know. And they said in this and she almost fell over. And then they got serious and said, well, seriously, yeah, he didn't want to tell you that you and your family were in danger because the Black Cups were threatening if he finished the Integraton, they're going to off you. So you have to come up with a cover story. I'll say, okay, just tell him that he died from a heart attack and do a memorial service, you know, do something
that's
like
amazing.
That. And that's how that thing came about.
Wow.
You know, so that was significant, you know, in the sense of what it led up to. You know, and of course, George Van Tassel, like so many of the pioneers, you know, were ridiculed by these so-called UFO experts, these professional UFO investigators and people working for MUFON. And I'm not saying that all of them had an ulterior motive, but I feel that 90% of them did when they claimed to be professional or conservative, you know, UFO investigators and that lunatic friends, that those contactees and pioneers, you know, they like to put that down. Mm-hmm. You know, but, and it was interesting, you know, when he, when you meet different people and you talk to different people, and having known George, and I met a large number of people who knew George Adamski, he was probably one of the most, you know, well-known. And he was especially targeted by the, later on, by the so-called UFO investigators who like to, you know, they want to take away the spirit of the whole thing. They want to talk about, oh, the mysterious lights in the sky or the negative abductions. And, of course, it's an interesting thing when you think about it, when they would often, some UFO researchers would say, what makes it authentic is the stark emotions, the terrifying fear. And I would think about it and say, why is something terrifying and negative more comforting, other than the implants in their bodies that would happen? You know, other than that, why is a negative emotion more authenticity, more authentic than a positive, uplifting, inspiring emotion or inspiration? Think about it. Are we so twisted that that's what they consider? Well, that's part of their hidden agenda, see? And so, in fact, a good example, you know, related to Bud Hopkins, who I connected with him in 1986. Not I didn't meet with him per se, but it was interesting. A professor from the Houston University came to get one of my personal 90-minute transformational channel readings from me. And he didn't feel he was an abductee. He just had an interest in UFOs. Well, he ended up being regressed by Bud Hopkins. And it was interesting because when I did a session for this man, and, you know, sometimes things will stick in my mind at Ashtar's channel through me because I'm supposed to remember so I can refer to it later. Even though I do forget so much because I've done so many thousands of these sessions.
Right.
So during the session, Ashtar made a comment that there was a session this man went through where disinformation was being generated because of it. And of course, Ashtar was talking about this guy's connection with the Galactic Council and, of course, the human-appearing beings as well as other species are major members of that council. Sure. Well, after the reading was over, the guy said, well, the only session I can think about is a hypnotic regression by Bud Hopkins. Now, think about this. How did Bud Hopkins, who was a professional artist, suddenly almost overnight become this expert on hypnotic regression?
And, yeah.
he claimed he wanted to help all the abductees. If you study the cases of all the abductees that he kind of used for public relations, like one named Kathy, and it was interesting because in Bill Cooper's book, Behold the Pale Horse, there's notarized affidavits in the back about a psychiatrist who had an interest in UFOs. He goes to a MUFON conference, and he said that one of the few more normal-looking people was this attractive lady that he connected with, who admitted to him that she was in the CIA, and Bud Hopkins was also in the CIA. Okay. Well, later when the psychiatrist who had quite a career and he had never been known to misuse his abilities, he really, really, truly wanted to help people. All of a sudden he starts getting, calls at night, like paranoia stuff, right? There's a psychiatrist. And it turns out that Bud Hopkins, because of his cover being blown, went after this guy with a vengeance and basically said, now that you came after me, I'm going to, you know, destroy you, basically.
Aww.
And he had to go before the psychiatric board. He had to, but he had never been known to misuse his ability. And all of a sudden, because of Bud Hopkins, and he tried to expose this, Bud Hopkins not really using the protocols and things that he should have been to really, as far as backup and support afterwards. He dropped people like a hot potato, this guy said, just to use them like Kathy, who is a famous abductee. And and when I heard about this, and of course, the guy was telling me, the professor, that, you know, Bud Hopkins was hanging out with him like he was a long lost friend, but really it was that we know that when somebody's regressed under hypnosis, later on stuff sometimes resurfaces. So I feel like what he was doing, he was seeing if anything else would come out. Well, as this guy told me, in this hypnotic regression, he has regressed not to an abduction incident, but to the Galactic Council, where human-appearing beings are talking with him, and he's part of the council, and he's blissed out. And Bud Hopkins says, this doesn't sound like an abduction. This sounds like reunion. And the way he said it was like he had said it before. It wasn't the first time. And I suspected that, you know, that even though in all his public presentations and news, you know, interviews, he always makes it sound like only grays and reptilian types are, you know, are exposed. But never anything about contact or intervention or the human appearing being. So I thought that's kind of interesting. So it turns out that I was about to go in about a month to Omaha, Nebraska to present share about my experiences. And this guy said that Bud Hopkins was going to be a guest at the local MUFON chapter and going to be a guest on a local talk show. So I thought to myself, well, I'm going to give him a little ringy poo. and ask him point blank about, you know, why is he leaving out the other type of beings? Because obviously this was not the first time. Mm-hmm. He claims he want to help the abductees, but it doesn't take a rocket scientist or brain surgeon to know that you could ask the other beings to intervene. Duh! And maybe they could intervene. Yes, they can. There's been many cases of it. And they would stop the abductions. And I remember one UFO conference when this guy was, you know, on one conference where they were openly talking about how they'd been abducted the night before. I might have mentioned this before. And on the next night, they're going to be abducted again. And one guy was acting like he was so concerned. He said, I don't know what to do about this. And said, why don't you call in the human appearing beings to intervene? And he kind of got a little bit, you know, he didn't know how to handle my response that way. Like, it was so clear and simple. But it was like they wanted to keep people in this victim kind of thing. Ashtar calls it a cosmic civil rights violation case.
I really want to stress to all the contactees that are listening to this interview that if you are a contactee, to be very cautious when you're contacting MUFON, because the facts and the research are really showing that a very high percentage of the people that contact them shortly thereafter end up getting MyLabbed.
Right.
And the difference between a contactee visit, which is more on a positive side, where they're really trying to get your attention, help you to remember who you are, what your galactic mission is, you know, remind you of your star family, that kind of thing, versus MyLabbing, which is really horrific. You know, you're basically abducted into underground bases. It's military related. You're usually going to interact with greys, reptilians, the nastier Nordic clan, that kind of thing. So it's just a heads up that is really, that's showing to be a definite trend.
Yeah. And of course, you know, it's just, and so anyway, this incident with, you know, Bob Hopkins, so sure enough, when he, you know, a month later, I'm in Omaha, and I give him a little ring, one of the first callers up, and I don't think he knew about me before him, but he sure knew about me afterwards. Well, so I just said I was a researcher. I didn't say I was a contactee, and I said, hey, you and I have an acquaintance. And I said, you know, and at first he was very open. He seemed to be very open and no problem. Right. And then I brought up about this man, and I said, you know, you had regressed him under hypnosis. And I said, I noticed that you never once mentioned about the human appearing beings. Well, I know for a fact, because he told me about the hypnotic regression you put him through, that you regressed him, you know, to a galactic council with human appearing beings. And he was very blissed out. And, you know, and you said, this doesn't sound like abduction. This sounds like reunion. Well, there's a few moments of uncomfortable silence. And he goes, I don't know what you're talking about. They got him me off the air. And I made a vow I was going to expose him eventually. Of course, he ended a few years ago, he died. I really, you know, but the interesting thing about, you know, I did a presentation at the Whole Life Expo in L.A. where I, you know, was talking, and I mentioned this incident with Bud Hopkins. And I had contacted a woman, got a reading from me, and I had spent had a few conversations over the phone with her. And she was a volunteer in Earth Embodiment, but she befriended Kathy, this you know, abductee that Bud Hopkins was using kind of as a publicity thing. And so the woman, you know, got her copies of that presentation. And you can imagine the crap hit the fan right after that. And then, and I had taught a few conversations with, how much more time we got there?
Oh, we've got 20 minutes.
Okay. So I'm talking to this woman, and a few days later, Wald Andrus, who I have mentioned before, I don't know if I mentioned earlier, but, you know, he started MUFON and he was in the NSA. You know, remember NICAP, National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena, who then did admit later that they were infiltrated by the CIA. There was also APRO, Royal Research Phenomena Organization. They got all infiltrated. And here's, you know, MUFON talking about that later. I thought, who's calling the kettle black? You know, wow. Here their own organization is started by an intelligence operative, Wald Andrus. And of course, I don't know if I mentioned this earlier, but when, you know, my ex and I had did a Whole Life Expo in New York, and Duncan Cameron came up, who looked at all the documentation, said, hey, this is great. Next thing you know, we have the Nexus publication, which was great because we weren't in a position to do a publication. And he interviewed this guy who was dying of cancer, who also knew George Hunt Williamson, he said they tried to recruit him, you know, because of he was pretty much of a genius and And I thought about when I was growing up and I goofed off at school all the time, how I knew if I had applied myself and drank the Kool-Aid and believed what they were telling me as an educated fool, they would have probably recruited me also for these things. So I just goofed off. And if you ever saw the movie True Genius with Val Kilmer, it's based on true incident, but it's actually kind of jazzed up a little bit. I think the student who finally doesn't take himself seriously because he just sees them, you know, and then they recruit these kids to work for this classified project, claiming it was something good, but it was really a killer satellite system. Of course, they turn the tables on him at the end. It's a really hilarious ending. Get back to this really a-hole who you just can't help but hate because he's such a, you know, he's just one of those people that is into himself and, you know, this kind of thing, anal retentive kind of person. But anyway, it's still based on a true story. But so it was interesting.
Michael, you really need to learn how to tell us what you really feel.
I know. I have this problem.
You just really have a problem holding things back.
So anyway, you know, it was interesting because so when after she got the tapes too, and then I was talking to this woman over the phone. Well, a few days later, Walt Andrews calls up under the pretense something about membership in MUFON. Because this woman was a member of MUFON, but she was very spiritual. She just liked to keep abreast of what was going on. And he starts bringing up about the very same points that she and I had discussed in our private phone conversation. In other words, he had heard either he himself was personally monitoring or he was listening to somebody else who was monitoring. Well, she got happy and she played dumb about it. But so a few days later, I decided to call up. And he answers the phone, and I start asking him a question. He goes, "Who is this?" And I said, "Michael Elish." Well, he hangs up immediately. But it was great because I let him know I know he knows that I know. Right. You know, kind of like, hey, what are we playing? Why are you playing these games when, you know, all this stuff that's... So that just felt that was, you know, very significant about, you know, and of course, you know, about going to all these conferences. Now, when I would go to these conferences, even though they didn't want me to after lecture, they didn't mind taking my money to, you know, for a booth. And there, so many times there were people show up who didn't know why they were even there because it was so negative. But then they connect with me and go, oh, this is why. And I do these little cosmic hors d'oeuvres, a little short channeling, and then set up a more longer 90-minute in-depth transformational channel reading for the different people. So it was great kind of doing an espionage mission to ground light, despite what they were doing to bring all this negative stuff into that.
Well, and one thing I want to clarify with everybody is Michael approached me that this was a really important interview to him to bring back the awareness of the old timers that blazed the trail for the ufology community who have either passed on or been taken out, you know. And so again, for those of you that are relatively new to the ufology community, make sure you check out some of these names such as George Adamski and George Van Tassel and Dr. Daniel Fry and Orfeo Angelucci, you know, just to name a few, and see the connecting dots. You know, most of them that I noticed were not only contactees who literally boarded ships and had the, I should say, balls to come out and share those experiences, even though they knew they were going to really catch some serious flack for it. And the majority of them met with Venusians.
Venusians, Martians, Saturns, Jupiterians. In other words, they're all human appearing.
Neptunians.
Yeah, they were all from, a lot of them, some were outside the solar system, but a lot of them were from the planets inside the solar system. And as I mentioned, Earth, just like Earth is hollow. That's a whole show we could do on the holler. I have that copy of Admiral Byrd's Secret Diary. So it's very interesting. And at some point, hopefully you can interview Zora from the Hollow Earth Network. I wanted to mention regarding... you know, the early pioneers, you know, what they went through, because there were thousands actually that were contacted, but only a few actually had the courage, because of so many they were concerned about their Earth families, to come out, like George Adamski and George Van Tassel, and openly do the work they were doing. There were so many thousands more who just couldn't fulfill their mission because of the, you know, the intimidation and the ridicule and all the stuff that they went through, or the threat of loss of jobs. Oh, that was a big thing with saying, if you don't, you know, stop this, you're going to lose your job, and threatening them with those kinds of things. So that had a, you know, had major effect.
Well, and I think Adamski is pretty intriguing to me because he literally transported himself to Palomar. You know, Palomar Mountain area. He bought 20 acres of land. Mm-hmm. He then supposedly, it says, he saw over 184 flying saucers, and he was literally visited mm-hmm. by these light-skinned human appearing beings. And their whole thing was about spreading the message of peace.
Yeah, and he wrote two major books. One is The Flying Saucers Have Landed and Aboard the Spaceships.
Right.
Now, in his initial contact, and he had six witnesses, George Hunt Williamson and five other people, watched him in the distance, you know, Orthon coming out of the Venusian scout ship and talking with him by the ship. All six of them signed notarized affidavits. Now, what's significant about that, all these UFO so-called experts who, these days, who debunk and ridicule the contactees, they can ignore that point. They're so much into so-called facts that they want to sidestep certain things that verify these earlier contact cases. The reason I bring it up, there's another UFO UFO researcher had made this statement. You know, it's interesting how you can be summoned to a jury duty. Of course, with National Liberty Alliance, we're going to bring the real jury, not these juries that are handpicked by the corrupt judge and bar attorneys and stuff. But in the so-called, you know, because it's such a corrupt judicial system, but it's interesting how even in a system they can, you know, sign and use a notarized affidavit that's considered, you know, important. And you can put a person away for life, supposedly, but when you have a UFO sighting or an experience, suddenly that testimony doesn't count anymore. But the fact that these six witnesses signed notarized affidavits, witnessed what was going on, but all the ones who want to debunk Adamski, they totally ignore or don't mention that fact. These people were so aware they wanted to document it in a lawful way. And those are the kind of things when you study their cases and then you hear the spin that the other people put on. I mean, in fact, Fate Magazine, which has been a metaphysical paranormal magazine, has been around for Fate Magazine.
Fate.
It's been around a long time, F-A-T-E. Okay. And Maria Curtis was the woman who owned it. Well, here's an interesting example of how they infiltrate organizations and stuff. I forget the so-called researcher's name, but he had actually worked for Maria Curtis, and he seemed like a good guy initially. And he used to talk about, and even in that one issue that came out, and this was, I'm trying to remember the exact date. Well, on the front cover, all of a sudden, after she passes away, it didn't take long for them to start using that publication to present this negative version about extraterrestrials. Because on the front cover, you see this really intense image of a gray abduction going on with a woman who's naked, laying on the chair, and traumatized and everything else. Well, in that publication, you know, I was also kind of referring to Murray Curtis, how balanced and fair she was, blah, blah, blah. And the guy, I can't think of the guy's name right now, well, he showed himself such an a-hole because initially he starts complimenting her for the very things that he himself starts doing, okay? Mm-hmm. Things that she wouldn't do, he did, because he said that doesn't have any axe to grind. She's very straightforward, and she was. She just presented the facts, like just the facts, ma'am. And when she initially talked about UFOs, it was not taking any particular side. It was both sightings, abductee, contact, anything that had to do with out of this kind of world stuff. It wasn't any agenda behind it. Well, that particular issue, and again, I don't have the issue in front of me. I forget what year it was. But it was not only, it was kind of referring to her, but there was all these articles about abduction. Mm. And then one of the articles was about those space or cosmic con men. Well, he was writing all about George Adamski, putting George Adamski down, taking things out of context, because he assumed that most people don't know all the story that I know right. about Adamski and George Van Tassel and these people. And he was trying to make it appear that they were just doing this to make a lot of money, making up their stories and all this crap. And he twisted so much, because I knew the stories in detail, and it was so obvious he twisted stuff around. And it was just, I mean, that's an example. On one hand, he's complimenting Maria Curtis for her not being a part of a hidden agenda and having an ex grand. Here he is doing the very thing he's complimenting her for not doing. And that was so blatantly. Had that article been in another issue, then I could say, okay, it was just about abduction. But when he put that in there, and not only with the abduction, and then putting down the contactees in the same issue, that was right. a blatant, obvious agenda to try to program, to try to, you know, for fulfilling this government cabal agenda and all these so-called UFO experts who, you know, who do that all the time, debunk the contactees because they assume most people who just woke up recently don't know all the facts. It's very hard to get some of these original manuscripts and books. Well, I have accumulated them through the years and not only met these people, but knew a lot of people who knew these people, and they had a lot of impeccable integrity.
So, Michael, through all the channelings that you've done, what is the ultimate thing that you feel the dark and the oppositional forces fear most about people finding out the truth about contactees?
Well, I think it comes down to becoming empowered with knowledge, knowing that we have an extended cosmic family, a whole community of worlds out there, majority of beings, even though there's some negative ones, is, you know, but the majority of them are benevolent. Majority of them adhere to a very high ethical service to collective sacred, you know, alignment. And they, and it's interesting how the UFO so-called experts, the UFO investigators always go, you think the benevolent space brothers are going to come down and save your butt? Well, one time Astra did this channeling, it was called, yes, the benevolent space brothers are going to save your butt. You know, and then he explained that, you know, he was referring to the statement of like, they're just, you know, like we're all on our own, we're cosmic isolationists, you know, and we're just, and we, you know, that's why you see all these movies of disasters and that we're always, that, like there's no outside force helping us. Well, that's, you know, not really, you know, because first of all, it's not a matter that us sitting around waiting for them to beam us up and we're just twiddling our fingers.
Of course
the truth is that we, the ground crew, because of our efforts and the work we've been doing, I mean, the boots on the ground, and as Astor always says, I mean, I, you know, he says that even though we know you didn't do this for rewards and acknowledgement, we still like to acknowledge and reward you. I mean, and we did this because, you know, and even though I say we do get hazardous duty pay, Purple Heart, halo, and wings, just, you know, our the quality is called unbearable compassion. It really is. We've been coming for millions of years. This comes through the readings all the time of, you know, we made a vow, we keep coming back until the job is done. So our efforts on the earth, on the earth level, give them mandated authority. So in the sense of them saving or helping us is the fact that we are saving ourselves. We are taking responsibility. We're empowering ourselves. We're grounding the light. And that effort is, and especially with new frequencies that have never been here before, Ellen can talk about this, new cosmic energies that are there, I've never experienced, are flooding the earth right now. And this is transforming. Our bodies are changing from carbon-based to crystalline silicon. Yeah. So all of a sudden, as more and more humanity wakes up, it gives them more mandated authority to step in. And of course, recently in the councils, it's my understanding that we have actually altered some of the galactic pacts, the prime directive, non-interference laws, giving us more authority because there's so many people waking up that, you know, that they can step in more and more behind the scenes as well as ultimately more overtly.
Well, the way I look at it, too, is the ground crew is the allied forces.
Yes.
Okay. And that's what we forget about. We're not separate from them.
Never have.
We're just kind of like, I hate to refer to it as like the Army versus the Air Force, but in a way it's true. We're just, we're here like in the trenches and they are consistently, at least in the messages I get, they're consistently stating that if more of us would request help, and assistance, so that it's this huge band of a consciousness frequency on the planet, and the bigger it gets, the more infiltrated we can be with the light and the assistance of the light.
Yes, well, that's why, you know, being discerning, really, and this has been, my whole life has been really focusing on is being as discerning as possible. Who's on the other end of the line as a channel? And as I've said a number of times, that to me, it doesn't matter whether it's human, galactic, interdimensional. I have a right to hang out with beings, to align with beings who have the same, embrace the same principles I do. And if energetically or intent, you make it really clear, I'm going to live my life according to these principles. Yeah. I don't want to, I'm going to head off at the pass. Yeah. I'm going to make it, you know, energetic as such that there's a cosmic security code around me, as there's always been when I've done my events and readings and stuff. And the only way I can connect with people, you know, because there are actually, when I do a session, one of my personal 90-minute transformational channel readings, and Astro always talks, refers to these two requirements that a person has to have. That a person doesn't even feel desire to get a reading unless they have met these two requirements. You know, and that, and it's because it has to do with, it's just, the work is too important to just, you know, just throw anything out there, that they take things very seriously and they want to give each light worker as much as they can. And as I've said many times, you know, Astro's comments about this, that, you know, I think they do a pretty good job in 90 minutes to compress out of trillions of misinformation. What can they share will help you the most.
Yeah.
And Ashtar, you know, he says that he doesn't relate to linear time at all. And he says he refers to me and he goes, yeah, he thinks this channel thinks we do a pretty good job to compress all this. He said, but actually, all we can really give you is less than the tip of the iceberg, even though he's talking very rapidly and he's sharing and downloading all this stuff. He says it's still just a flash, little in 90 minutes, a huge amount is shared. And it's like, but it's still, you know, it's so much more that they want to share. And but there is, of course, it's not just the conscious information, it's the higher latent encodements that they're downloading. And I'm doing these sessions that the conscious mind doesn't hear, but the subconscious does. So as people play back the session, more than just when they experience it, that's when things start to cause a transformational effect.
And I want to add to that, because I've had a couple of readings from you, mm-hmm. and I get more actually after I listen to it a couple of times. There's information I didn't either catch mm-hmm. or I didn't fully comprehend it until I listened to it a couple of times. Like, you know, it's clear to me that there's so many encodements in the information that you're relaying. And, you know, I want to share with everyone that I have a friend that's known Michael for years. And before I even met Michael, he was saying to me that he just knew because of his own personal experiences, he was a very intuitive, very connected, very galactically oriented guy. And he had shared with me that he felt Michael was by far one of the best channelers out there, and which is another reason that they've tried to off him.
Yep.
You know,
mm-hmm.
We have so much negativity out there about channelings. But in reality, look how many of those channelings still play a part. It's all about the discernment, number one. Mm-hmm. And yes, there's definitely channelings out there that are being done by black ops.
Yep.
You know, you'll be the first one to agree
with
that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. In fact, they had a thing connected with what is called Project Bluebeam,
right.
where they were going to project, you know, because the human race has been fooled so much. Well, Cabal was planning to project these holographic images into the sky. Now, they actually, the higher forces let them try it out briefly, where they projected an image of Jesus
Sweden,
in the sky and Canada. And then in Iraq, and the reason the Iraq war came to it, they actually projected an image of Muhammad. Whatever Muhammad really looks like, I'm not supposed to, you know, but they projected an image and they all threw their weapons down and thought their prophet was coming back. And after that, the Air Force said, okay, that's it. You know, humanity would be, it is so realistic, we're going to neutralize this. Now, this has gotten around the internet and the conspiracy, you know, community, who, of course, not being aware of higher forces intervening, they're concerned about this possibility because, yes, one of the plans by the Cabal was through this MyLab thing, and one of the things they were doing through the UFO conferences and they've been doing for years, they had cloned the Greys. They were planning, actually, to do an alien invasion scenario to fool humanity, you know, because even Wernher von Braun and his assistant said this about what they were planning to do was to create these threats. Mm-hmm. And that one of them would be, the final threat would be, E.T. would be, quote, invading Earth, would be kind of that. And you know, all these other things that kind of come about, well, that was what they were planning to do. That's, you know, so, but the Air Force said, well, that's your plan. We've got a better plan. So they neutralized it, but they let it act out a little bit to you know, let the negative forces.
Bring the awareness,
yeah,
too,
to me,
right?
And to make, yeah, make the information available. And plus, if we're aware of something, we go, okay, I'm going to head that off at the pass. I'm also going to stand firm in my sense as a guardian and neutralize their ability as a ground crew, which again gives them more authority to step in. So when we're discerning and we really desire, I don't care what it is, how intensely challenging it is, how so-called even vile it is when it's stuff that Cabal has been doing and it's a planetary movement. I want to know that truth because I believe that God never gives me more than I can handle. I believe if I'm discerning, want to know the truth, and I say, give it to me fully and completely. Let me take the red pill because I want to know what it is because I know God will give me plenty of solutions. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a lot of people today who, because now they're suddenly waking up and all the stuff that was hidden is now in their face. This comes through the readings a lot and they're going, oh my God, everything's getting worse. No, it's getting better. You're just now becoming aware of the stuff that you didn't want to deal with before. In fact, one of the beings I channel is Volter, who's a cosmic psychotherapist and, you know, has an interesting insight. And he said, you go to a million Earth psychotherapists and they just can't get rid of some of the stuff that's going back genetically. But with the LM technology, and you can actually, you know, ask before you go to sleep to go aboard the Jupiter 1, which is a ship Volter works out of, and in the accelerator chair. Now, it's interesting. I've had a number of people, when it's come through the readings or I've shared it, who have told me they got a brief little glimpse. They asked this, you know, kind of get a confirmation. They had a little glimpse of themselves sitting in this very comfortable translucent chair with all these colored lights shooting back and forth. That's the accelerator chair in the Jupiter 1. You know, the fact that they saw it, and actually was referred to the fact that I, you know, had people come back to me, you know, which is just one of the many things that makes it really interesting when you see these confirmations and people going through changes. And by, and it's not, it proportionate how much you use or utilize the information and the playing back the session is how much you're going to get out of it, because they don't want to force help down our throats. That's not their style. Right. It's us utilizing and really sincerely wanting to make a difference that allows that shift to occur.
Well, okay. So I'm so sorry about the blip in the recording, but hopefully we've recaptured some of the things that we discussed before. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure Michael will come on again and we'll go into some of the other cool stuff that he's talked about. But if you want to, please check his website out. It's michaelalesian.com. Michael Alesian, E-L-L.
Elegion, Elegion. Elegion. Cosmic French.
Elegion.
Elegion.
E-L-L-E-G-I-O-N.
Means legions of light.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And he is really awesome. And he does a 90-minute transformational personal reading. He'll send you a CD, so you can listen to it over and over again.
Yes.
You're going to want to, because there's so much information that comes out that, you know, you can't possibly remember it all. But it is quite unique from anything I've ever done, and I do personally recommend it. He is very good at what he does. So if you want some assistance with your galactic journey, and you know, just where your mission and your purpose is going, that kind of thing, you can ask him. You do let them have questions.
Oh, at the end, there's always a question and answer period for anything you want to get more clarity on.
Okay.
And the thing about with Asher always comes in for no matter who I do, because he's in charge of Earth missions, but with women, after he talks, there's always some a goddess, ladies, commanders. There's always equal time up there. They represent.
Always,
and I always tell people I'm pretty screwed in my feminine side, because they're very feminine, very powerful when they're coming through me.
Yeah. And he talks like this. No, I'm just kidding. Anyway, so thanks again, everyone. Mm-hmm. Lots of love. Stay tuned. We will be bringing on another cool show. Check out BBS Radio Station 2 Tuesday afternoons from 3 to 4:55 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And as always, don't forget to keep checking out galacticconnection.com, their blog, our products and services. We have so much stuff that's about to pop here. We just need a little more time. Please be patient with us, all of you that have placed orders, who have just been kind of hanging and waiting for your personalized remedies and that kind of thing. We'd really appreciate your time, because there's a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes that's really exciting. And that's all I'm going to say. So stay tuned, and we'll talk to you soon. Thanks again. Mm-hmm.